Okay, welcome to Deep Dive into Water Safety. I'm very excited today to have someone who is an international expert on drowning and flood and management. And this guest is Adrian Mayhew. He's the Director of National Operations and Safety at Surf Life Saving Great Britain. In his role, he provides operational oversight, guidance, and support to all Surf Life Saving Great Britain clubs regarding safety, rescue readiness, and national lifeguard standards. He's also chairs the Rescue Operations Committee for Surf Life Saving Great Britain and collaborates with international life saving and flood rescue organizations. He sent me a resume that is pages long, and I could go into that, but I want to hear about Adrian Mayhew's story, and you will gain a lot of information about drowning prevention. We all know that here in the state of Hawaii, we have the second highest drowning rate. The leading cause of death for children 1 to 15 is drowning, and only 2% of our second graders have any water safety skills. And we also know that the World Health Organization has raised the issue that it's a global public health issue, and we should all be collaborating and working on local and national and international issues. So, welcome, Adrian, to Deep Dive into Water Safety. And I have all this research I want to go into, like the thermal demands of flood rescue and impacts of task performance, experience, beliefs, and attitudes of lifeguards from Australia, United Kingdom toward lifeguard involvement, exploring flood response challenges, training needs, and the impact of online flood training, and float to live inexperienced water users in realistic open water conditions. I did not mention that you work with Mike Tipton, who was on our show before, and people were really interested in that and understanding that floating is a very important issue. And we were able to be part of his campaign, Find Your Float in Kauai, and we had the junior lifeguards do part of that. And it's brought an awareness to people that you could be a great swimmer, but if you do not know how to float or to stay calm in those situations. So, welcome. With all your experience, I want to know your story, and everybody needs to know your story so they can gain more information about how to stay safe in the water. And on top of it, Adrian, you're an elite athlete who does Ironman. So I want to know how you spend all this time doing research, work for Surf Life Saving Great Britain, do all this wonderful work, go to the conferences, go to the conference that you're about to have, you just told me, in Great Britain. And then I think you're going to go to the World Conference in Egypt. Is that correct?
So, yeah, it's a pretty busy schedule with the World of Life Saving, definitely. But thank you for
So
having me.
thank you for taking your time at 7:30 at night in the Cotswolds, I think. And so please start. Please tell us all about your story because I found it
Well,
very
it
interesting.
started when I was about 7 as a young little boy on the beach in Cornwall, a place that you know. And I saw the lifeguards do a very epic rescue in the old reel and line method, and they went out into some big waves, rescued this person out of the water. And I was kind of gobsmacked and shocked that most of my superheroes were from Marvel, you know, Captain America and places like that, and Spider-Man. And then all of a sudden, these guys in red trunks brought this person out in huge waves, and risked their lives to save somebody else. And that was the moment where I thought, I want to know a little bit more. And so I had to find my own life-saving club in the area. It just so happened, this is when I was a young little lad, the dinner lady that looked after us in the middle school said, we have a life-saving club in Pershore, where I live. And they said, why don't you come along to that? And I had to do a swim test at 25 meters. And then that was the start of a journey which I had no idea I'd go down on. So amazing, amazing, amazing moments. And that lady now is still around at the life-saving club. She's in her late 80s. She still comes along and clips my ear if I'm a bit naughty. So, but she started it, and I've met wonderful people. And I've always said that, you know, these people have come across my life and shared moments that hopefully I can carry on with their legacies to improve my knowledge, which I can then share with other people. So, you know, I'm a kind of a kind of a menagerie of people's thoughts, expressions, research, and all that. So hopefully, with that, and then be very grateful for sharing that with me, I can share that and improve on how modernization and life saving has occurred, and where we need to look for the future, which you've alluded to in the research that we are involved with.
Right. So I'm looking at the information you sent me, and I found this really interesting because living here in Hawaii, I had no idea. So in 2007, July 2007, can you tell us what happened in the UK? Because
Yeah,
I had no idea.
that was when the war we realized that climate change then hit the UK with a big whopping punch. And on that day, in the middle of the summer, we had the biggest flood in the history since the 1600s, where over 9,000 lives were rescued, and we saw flooding on a biblical scale, and things like traveling, asking for help for a fire engine to travel to help you out, which is only 6 miles away, took half a day to get to you, because the roads were underwater, and tributaries that had been silent for millions of years woke up and changed rivers' direction, and all of a sudden we just found people climbing into attics, roof space, and saying, "Rescue me, rescue me." And so, over a whole week, we were operating at a level that we've never done before, but it's with great thanks that unfortunately we made a mistake back then in the fire service back in the late 90s, where we lost a firefighter who didn't understand about flooding and rainfall and what it can do. And then that led to Her Majesty's Inspectorate to say, "We have to do something about it. It can't just be a lifeguard standard. There needs to be more knowledge." And our freedom of information of a request around the world came to Charlotte Fire Department and the North Carolina Emergency Management that had gone through the same process, lost their own firefighters. We shared tears, and that was it. That was a moment that we learned from them, spent months out there training to learn everything we could. Just how lucky it was at 2005 and 2006, our training with them and our friendship, and that still goes on today. We applied that knowledge in 2007, and thanks to them and thanks for sharing, 9,000 people are here today.
Wow, that's an amazing story. So you're an expert on flood management and rescue, and you talk a lot about climate change. We had a flood here, which I didn't send you information on, in 2018 in Kauai, in Hanalei. And we only have one road in and out of here. And it was a big disaster. And out of that came the Hanalei Initiative, which made this infrastructure to keep us more resilient. But maybe you could talk about that because we haven't talked about floods and in our water safety issue. And you know that climate change is a big issue. Mike Tipton just had a big conference in the UK about that. And you talk a lot about that. So whatever you'd like to share would be really
Yeah, well,
important.
we're seeing, I mean, whether people agree with climate change or climate extremes or not, that can be debated by far greater experts than me. But what we have looked at is the evidence of increased impact over 50 years. So when I was over in Australia and working with Surf Life Saving Australia and trying to get to them about the initiatives, we could see not just an exponential growth over hundreds of years, over 50-year blocks, but if we look at where we are in the last 50 years, or this 50 years from 2000 onwards, everybody's doubled their flood experience and more. And we've not even got to the next 50, not even come to, we're only 25 years up to that point. So we've already doubled our flood incidents in each country. It doesn't matter which country it is, we're over that, and it's going to get more and bigger. And things we've learned now is, the temp when we get a storm cell that's sitting out in the Atlantic or the Pacific, it doesn't really matter. We now know that when we hit the water surface temperature of around 29 to 32 degrees Celsius, I'm not quite sure what that is in Fahrenheit, that storm cell sucks up water into the atmosphere. And things like hurricanes, as you get over there, it's like a mangy dog that's not eaten for 6 weeks. It just sucks that water up and then wants to drop it somewhere. And we know from when you had Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, that was the first one. And that was only a Category 3, jumped up to a Cat 4, then jumped back down to a Cat 3 as it hit landfall. And now, very often in your areas, you're seeing numbers of Category 5 hurricanes. Now, n and now discussions are being: what does a hurricane Category 6 look like? Is the amount of water in there? So, if we look at, for example, the data on Hurricane Harvey that landed in your south area of America, Houston City actually sunk by 4 centimeters, by an inch. And if you look at that volume of water in an infographic, if you did a line around Houston City and drew that blue line column straight up into the sky, well, that would reach up to 2 miles. So you think the weight of water that was pushing down on Houston, and this is happening everywhere. It's happening. We're seeing horrendous stuff going on in India, in Japan, Spain, Australia. When I literally over there in a couple of years ago, and then they got whacked. All states got whacked by the biggest floods in their history. That's a problem. Why is it a problem? Because it infects infrastructure and it affects people, and it affects. We don't have a proper rescue response. Defense systems are behind those curves. And so, and funny enough, working with the World Health Organization, the biggest thing I've been doing recently with them on their technical group is changing the word from national to an international problem, because flooding doesn't care about where you live, doesn't matter the borders or your religion or your faith or wherever you're going, it will hit everybody. And the other thing is this impression, which is where you look at for your island out there, is the coastal inundation threat, and that starts to have an impact. So the worry is twofold: is the economic, a couple of things, economic, structural sense, but also the places where we live, and especially for lifesavers, that's our beach. And in 100 years' time, that beach might change. The infrastructures we built for lifesaving may not be there anymore, and then all of a sudden, we might have to work backwards, or we might have more extremes. So the recent report from Australia, where if the temperature hits 3 degrees, we'll see Sydney having nearly 100 days of flooding, in the city, which affects millions of people. So what, so what we're seeing is the evidence of that. And then from a life-saving point of view is the death rate. Flooding is not the World Health Organization doesn't calculate drowning. 268,000 people drown every year. It's around 40 per hour. And if we added the flood disaster systems into that, and which we don't, that could be double. And already we know that with the World Health Organization, drowning is the top five leading cause of morbidity around the world. So we put flood disaster in, this could be one of the global biggest problems we've ever seen by the end of my lifetime, anyway.
That's really discouraging.
Yeah.
So, what are you doing about this? Because I could see you are doing a lot. So, tell me more. What can you tell?
So we're trying to share the message. So we've got there's enough modeling going on around the world by experts in this, but it's trying to link research, as taking the word from Mike Tipton, who you interviewed a few weeks ago. It's lab to life saving. So he that's how we get on. He sits with me and he says, where do we put the research? And I said, well, I need the research to get information out to make it, we call it a child storybook, a Janet and John message, make it basic so people understand those situations. So we know what to do. We know how to prepare. And if you look at, say, countries like Bangladesh, who have no infrastructure whatsoever, their early warning systems are so good, and they move people from a bad place to a good place really quickly. So how do they do that with no flood PPE or rescue boats and engines? And how do they do that? So there is stuff to be learned about messaging in a simple way. There's stuff that cultural wise we need to move before the curve. And yes, probably 8 times out of 10, that why do we walk out the house and move up the hill when it was dry anyway? Well, yes, but it's going to happen. And so being prepared, having the basics around that, and having the understanding that defense investment needs, but also recovery and rescue as well. So it starts now. I mean, with the UK flood, it's taken, we're 25 years and we're still not perfect in the UK. It's taken about 30 years for the states to get there. They're still learning. Australia's just started in 2017 with their work. This is something that we have to do, and it doesn't take a year. It takes decades to build that infrastructure, that money investment in, and to create that legacy that's going to be there for our grandchildren,
So you're talking about every country but the United States. You know anything about
Yeah.
what we're doing? Because I
Yeah.
don't. No?
Yeah, well, the states are doing a really good job. You look at your program out there for flood disaster. You have fantastic task forces. A lot of countries look to what the states are doing and seeing how they can learn from that. And you see the leaders of North Carolina and Charlotte Fire Department doing an amazing job and have been the leaders. And then you see New York and California and Texas have all jumping in with that. And that's a federal-based country, and we're seeing that in federal-based Europe and federal-based Australia. But there are still people not realizing what you need, and still countries like Spain are getting hit with epidemic kind of levels of rainfall, where buildings and cars are, it looks like something like just been bombed out. And what they're asking for help, and they don't know. So the job is now, is with my international hat on, is trying to coordinate the knowledge where that investment is going, really trying to help them, to help governments realize that you need to do something, because lots of people are going to be involved, and that's what we've got to try and help them, coast or inland.
So messaging, you're saying simple messaging based on culture, based on what you saw in Bangladesh, is that correct? Is that what
Yeah,
you're
it's just
talking
so
about?
yeah, some of the stuff we've seen now, it's just simple messaging. Early warning systems is what we want. People to understand that basic early warning message. And it can be like green, yellow, amber, red. It doesn't have to be difficult, but have some context around that, and then people will know what to do. Have stuff like our parents had in, back in World War II or things like that. Have a candle, have a battery, have a torch. Simple stuff like that, where we actually are prepared for if there's a flooding. There's great advice by the World Health Organization. There's great advice definitely in the States, but that's not transpiring around the world enough. And then and that's great to moving lots of people, but there needs to be a process where emergency managers need to make sure that when there's lots of people involved, how do we move them out? How do we get rescue response? And more importantly, when we're dealing with that rescue response, that we're when we those teams come in, and America have done this really well, that we don't take away the very food and the water, the very people who need help there. So there's a task force behind a task force, to make sure that the responders can do their job well, and they can get fed and watered and cleaned and first aid measures and things like that that we take for granted. But the thing is, if the community's in trouble, we cannot take anything away from the community. And then there's another thing about bringing support for the community behind that as well. So it's a complex issue with a lot of blending going on. But incident managers need to understand those things, in all countries at all levels. It's not going to go away, and if not, morbidity rates are going to be catastrophic if we haven't got those systems in place. And if we look at the UN Sendai framework, which is designed for preparedness, the four priorities is being prepared, having resources to deal with those areas, and having a good, they call it build back better. Be prepared to invest and build back better for the next one on or the one next, and keep practicing. So there's advice out there, but I'm staggered sometimes that a lot of countries and a lot of people are unaware of that great advice.
Even locally, we can get just kind of complacent about things. Well, we had this flood, and so now it's back to how it is, and we kind of think about it. The people who were impacted think about it a lot, but I'm up the hill from it, so maybe I'm not thinking about it. It rains. We had like 40 some inches of rain within 24 hours, which caused that, and we're kind of in a rural island. And you're talking about hurricanes. We had a t significant hurricane 20 some years ago called Iniki that just hit Kauai really badly. So, yes, we have those kinds of things, and being prepared is really important. I agree with that. And so, you did some research, thermal demands of flood rescue and impacts on task performance. Did you find out with that, with my
Well,
lab to life saving?
yeah, back to like we well, this is exactly right. People gotta look after our lifesavers and our responders. So what happens when you can't wear a wetsuit? Because it's a biohazard. It's a contaminated water. All the sewage, agricultural, industrial wastage, bacterial load is huge in the water. So, and people don't realize that. So when you see kids playing in flood water with their bicycles, and their action toys, what are you doing? Don't go there. So we wear dry suits, which you see often with people like America, with their helmets and their life jackets, their personal flotation devices. So what happens when you move? What tasks are good? What tasks are bad? And what's happening to your body? So, because when I get tired, as a manager, how do I know when to pull you out so I can bring a new set of bodies to come in and help out afterwards.
Right.
So we learned some things, and we did this. It was hilarious because we first one did the hot one, no, so we did the cold one, and I was miserable. So one was about on a cold day. I mean, we did two studies. One's the coldest day in the UK, and one was the warmest day, which was the July floods.
Yep.
So the coldest day was wind, rain, and to see what would happen to our strength, our dexterity, and our mental cohesiveness. So you had to stand under these elements in Mike's laboratory, and I don't do cold at all. And my face in one of the pictures says it all. You could make as much expletives around that as you want. I hated that moment. Where Mike, being a pale skin and not great in the sun, he loved it. He was happy, smiling around. But we saw, dexterity go around 18%. And this is in the first hour, reminding you that these people are rescuing over days, hours, days, and weeks. But we then started to see huge peripheral cooling. So things that the military would know about is non-freezing cold injury, where applied coldness around your nose and your face and your hands
Yeah.
start to have long-term impact. Well, not quite. It's not kind of frostbite, but it's very, very cold, and we actually don't know what happens after that because we haven't tested it. But we start to see strength go as well. So when we're seeing responders disappearing and getting cold and jumping in the boat and out the boat, they're losing all their strength. They're losing their capability for rescue. So that would mean that in those conditions, we need to keep people then warm. So having a warming up area, keeping them food and calories, so they're ready to go, and so they're not over getting too cold, and then their decision making becomes poor through cold injuries and cold illness. And if you're thinking of rescuing, or you're lowering, and you're using ropes to attach to boats to lower down, if your dexterity goes, well, the chance of a fatal mistake is huge.
Wow.
So we put all that in there, and then we did the hot day, and Mike's
Remember
face was. Well, Mike just, I loved it because it was, and we looked at what
that.
walking around the myth do CPR afterwards with the first aid to see if we could still do it. Well, Mike got so hot that when he was doing a mannequin pushy, pushy, pumpy, pumpy, blowy, blowy, sparky, sparky, I said, "How are you getting on, Mike?" He said, "I don't care if he lives or dies. I'm just knackered," he said. "I'm just absolutely shattered." Sweat pouring off him, looking like, don't want to be here. But what we saw there is the amount of calories burned from walking in water, and just all the test was is moving somebody in a flume of water of a couple of mile an hour carrying a 10 kilogram load, which could be a raft or a boat floating. We saw about nearly a liter of up to a liter of sweat being lost in an hour. And we saw
Wow.
between 600 to 800 calories being burned. Now, that might, it is a lot, but you say that over like 4 hours, the calories you're burning is a half Ironman. If you look at the hydration, most people's gut will only pull through about 600 mil, like two Coke cans. That's all their gut can carry before they start having gut problem. So if you're losing that, these people, these responders are falling apart after the first morning at a rescue site. So how do we look after them? How do we stop them overheating? Because being cold is one problem, overheating is another. But we can't put them back in a wetsuit because a wetsuit keeps you warm, but then you've got contaminated water in your skin, and then we lose you for bacterial viruses and illnesses. So we
Right.
lose the whole complete rescue response. So in essence, all that work has been put into a document in our government policy. We've put it into Australia. And we're starting to share that around the world. But it was the first research paper around flood rescue response ever to be done in the world, because everything's just been leisure orientated. We'll borrow that and we'll borrow this. And we're going, hang
Right.
on, what happens?
Have you shared that with the United States?
I'm actually coming over there next year in the end of April with a masterclass with my friends from Australia now. And again, hopefully it's all in the early stages, but with North Carolina Emergency Management, we're going to be doing something as a world level masterclass,
Oh, that's
sharing
great.
everybody's agency response and sharing this research. So yeah, perfect.
And is it going to be a conference or what? What is it going to be?
No, no, hopefully a conference or something like that. We haven't, it's early stages, but we're just having the talk. But we're going to, I'm pretty sure by the time we get to Egypt, which is the World Drowning Conference in about 3 weeks' time,
I think
we'll
you
have
should
it
make
sorted
it in
out.
Hawaii. You should come.
Well, get me over there. That'd be great. Just around October, as you know.
There was an article written 2 years ago, and it got me started on this that said that Hawaii should be the water leader in the United States for safety. I mean, we're stuck out in the middle of Hawaii, of the Pacific Ocean, and we have a history of legendary men and women, water people, and we kind of lost our way, is what our water safety plan said. So that's really interesting research. Wow.
I mean, it's good because it helps us too. But also with the other research, with the looking at with South Africa and with Australia, we know that lifesavers have a really good input into flood disaster. You're changing your wetsuit to a dry suit. They know how to put PFDs. They know how to read the water. I've come from the fire service, and I've taught over 3,000 firefighters who are not water experts how to be a flood rescue technician. And I've taught around 1,000, 1,500 surf lifesavers who get it really quick. They drive boats, their base groundwork is amazing. They're already rescue swimmers, so that's done. All I've got to do is just tweak them here and there, change their hydrology, change their thinking about incident management and their process. But if you look at their fundamental basic skills, they can swim, they can drive boats, they can rescue, drive rest jet skis, they can provide first aid and CPR. They're all those things and have a risk management bubble around it. All we've got to do is mold it. So the basic foundations of life saving and lifeguards are already there. All we've got to do is just slightly change it from one area to another. And I have never seen anything like it with lifesavers who've just, with their understanding of driving boats, their understanding of water, how they can do things much quicker. And that's not to take away, statutory services like fire or police because they do a fantastic job. But, if you're born in water, you read water so quickly that actually they are the people that can do the job,
I'm so glad you say that, but in the United States, lifeguards are not considered first responders. We're still working on that, which is terrible, I think. And you talk to any firefighter here and they'll say, "Oh, great, there's a lifeguard that got to it before we did." That makes us much more comfortable, right?
Well, we were the same over here. We took a long time above with fire, police, and ambulance, and all those things. They're under the what we call the United Kingdom Search and Rescue framework, and it took a lot of work when I joined Surf Life Saving to get lifeguard operations inside that, because guess what? We prevent. And if you look at what we do, if you look at a great study in South America, they looked at the chain of survival and rescue. There, over 1.6 million cases was looked at, and how many people did the CPR, and how many interventions, how many preventions. If you do into prevention really well, which makes up 99.6% of the total 1.6 million in results and in of the database, your CPR bit is less than 0.01% because of that. So isn't that a really good way of stopping the incident before it happens? And that's what lifeguards do. They know that thing. But guess what? Lifeguards can also do the hard part when it's needed. So I think people forget, because they do so good in intervention and prevention work, that they forget there's huge skill base within lifeguards that guess what? They know risk, they know risk management, and they can work as a cohesive team. All we've got to do is put a framework around them and then let them go.
Wow, that's a really good message. You should say that loud over and over again.
I did it in the UK, so we're getting there.
We need you here to say that. That's great. So here's another piece of research I'm looking at.
Yes.
Survey-based research exploring how surf lifeguards perceive their role in flood response and the challenges of equipment training and risk awareness. I don't know if that's something you want to talk about.
So that was a good research paper because it's exactly what we've just been talking about is everybody, whether it's been in Germany or in South Africa or in Australia or New Zealand, everybody's had the same thing. We're here, we're water people. Why aren't you using us? And if you look at DLRG, which is the German life-saving organization, they were kind of didn't fit into the responders. So they just turned up. I love it when you listen to Germany's response. They just turned up with a boat. They didn't care. And then eventually they, dare I say it, bullied, I'll probably get told off for that. But they proved a point that they could do really good stuff and just start working. And it's like the concept behind that was going, how do we use a research paper to tell the world that lifesavers can do a job? And that's and then and what do they want to do? So by running basic courses through the internet, through meeting them in a classroom, to workshops, to master classes. It showcases the life-saving world of skill sets. And what my job is to try and do now is to try and say, use these skills. This is a natural organization that have a load of layers of life-saving capability. And if you can't, if you're too worried about getting them in the water because it's too this and too that, well, they can provide first aid and healthcare. Why not that? Because if you look at, if we look at, let's just take for example, a nice interesting fact with Western Australia, they got hit by floods. Just one major flood cost $7.7 billion in that. And if we take that segment out and go, how much does it cost? How much did it cost the state on injury and illness in hospitalization? Well, in
Right.
that 7.7 was $83 million. And how much did the economy lose during that period? $369 million. Well, one flood investment response over 10 years in the UK has cost $112 million. It's paid for itself in one flood.
Right.
We've got to get people around going, well, you haven't got these people because what the fireys are going to be busy, the police are going to be busy. So when the world goes wrong, you need people trained. Well, why not use the volunteer section of the life-saving family that can be integrated, be trained in a framework, and sit under your guidance in your operational plan, and they'll do what they're told. But all of a sudden, if you put people and equipment, you have an asset. Let's use those assets.
That's really interesting information because we don't have that strong volunteer program here in the United States. It's all around lifeguards. But the idea is the same because people will say, well, tell us how much this is going to cost us to do this program or that program. But what you're saying is the flood cost $8 billion and you could have spent $150 million to prevent these kinds of things from being as disastrous as they are.
And it goes back to priority
Right.
three and Sendai, build back better, get everybody recovered. And every time you're not earning money, the state or the country is underwater and people are in recovery. The longer you're in recovery and rescue, the more you're using money. So let's get people to do the job, get you ready, get you back into the fight, make money, and get yourself back working. Well, that can't, you need help. The people who are underwater need help. So let's use a resource there. It's as simple as that. It might look a lot of work, but it's like anything. If we get more hands make light work and do what we need to do, it means the economy and the people get back to their livelihoods a little bit quicker.
Do you think things are changing? Age.
Yeah, I do. You don't, you think I started this, I was laughed at the first when I spoke about this 20 years ago, I was laughed out of a conference. They thought I was cuckoo. And didn't want to listen to me. And then 2 weeks later, we sent our first flood team out to up in the northeast. And then they came back 4 days, and we went sent them out to another flood. And then some apologies started coming in, and that's how that started. You wouldn't believe the disbelief from people that I've had to deal with over the decades, and yet we just keep pushing on and pushing on.
I'm so impressed because Dwayne DeSoto said the same thing. He's been working on what he's doing for 20 years, and he told me the word was persistence.
Yeah.
And here he is 20 years later, and he's made an impact in Hawaii for water safety and swimming in the schools and the whole cultural piece. But he's been working on it for 20 years too, just
Yeah,
like you.
they've got to leave a legacy, you know. Whoever's passed that baton on to him, you've got to pick that up like he's doing, Roman legacy. And I think the right people need to question why is this person putting a lot of effort, you know. And the facts are very clear in Hawaii. The fact globally is the same problem, you know. That hasn't changed. Kids drown.
Right.
It's the top three biggest killer in the world of kids of under the age of 12. You know, it's the third biggest killer around the world globally for low-income countries. And even in the UK, it's still the fifth biggest killer. You know, every 2 days, somebody drowns in the UK. That's the stat.
Right.
And here's an interesting stat from the UK we calculated from the government's Green Book that works on social costing of a life lost. When we worked that out, it's worked out one life is worth 60,000, which is, you know, which is around $70,000 for you guys. We
Right.
times that by the death rate, you're a third of $1 billion
Right.
a year being lost. That's it. So let's do something about it.
I know. I commend you for what you're doing. And I think working with Mike from Lab to Life Saving is a great line. I really like it because what's the point of having research or even a plan if it sits someplace up in a bookshelf? Right. And you're going around doing the great work, Adrian. I'm just like so impressed. So here's the one I want you to talk about, because it made a big impact for people. They had a hard time listening to Mike because he was so technical, but then we kept talking about it, and then we actually did the Find Your Float, which I think we're going to be involved with that next year if he keeps that campaign going.
Yeah, good.
So tell me about that. Float to Live, inexperienced water users in realistic open
It's
water
a
conditions.
here's the interesting thing. The World Health Organization, and this is where I with my and I'm on the technical group of drowning with that, which is great. But the point being is it does say around 25 meters swim, but that's not a cultural support system for people in low income countries.
Right.
You know, they've got to go to a lake or a river, and yes, it will be safe, and yes, they can, but that doesn't mean nothing. And actually, the swim 25 meters, all we're advocating is, yeah, the moment you hit the water and your physiology changes against that cold water, and bearing in mind cold water is 0 to 24 degrees Celsius, you
Right.
can have that cold shock response. And as Mike would say, your receptors in your skin from cold to warm are about 10 to 1. So this impact is huge there. So why are we asking people? Yes, swimming is important, but let's float, because why that response goes off and it will dissipate afterwards, it's probably the biggest contribution to drowning globally around the world that we don't know about.
Right.
So what do we want to do? We wanted to change the perception of that 25 meter badge, because that doesn't work in low income countries or even middle income countries. What we want to do is, if you fall in, float. But what did it mean? So they came to us, Portsmouth, and they said, we've got to look about moving water. So we had a look around and did some work on that. And the principles were still the same. You know, if we can get people to float, then then you can breathe. If you can breathe, you can get your brain into gear to go, what am I doing and how am I getting out of here? So how do we float? People float in different positions. You don't have to be the starfish, which is what the kids are taught. The
Right.
main thing for us was the counterintuitive thing, which we brought across, is when you lie on your back, drop your ears into the water, and that will bring your hips up. Now, that's probably a message for backstroke swimmers that know that, where you lie back, push your hips up, is always you're taught by a swimmer. And the principle is because their ears are in the water. So having that fundamental knowledge from my days of a swimming as a swimming club swimmer, we knew there was perception around that. The next part of it for moving water was to go feet first. So if you had to look around, you could defend your feet against any objects in the ocean or in the flow of water, because we wanted to protect against entrapment. But using gentle sculling and leg movements helps support that. So we have a mnemonic in Surf Life Saving GB called STAR. So that mnemonic is effectively spread yourself out. T is tilt your head back in, bring your ears into water. A is use your arms and legs to scull. R, just relax. And that's your mnemonic for STAR, just to float like a star, just helps you relax in the water. And what does that do? The basic Janet and John situation of the physiology of landing in water is quite extreme, where we can go from swim failure very, very rapidly through either breathing in or inhaling or ingesting the water, losing muscle function really, really quickly, and having that really horrible effect where nervousness and self-survival starts to creep over and shadow our responses and our thinking. What we want to do in that first 60 to 120 seconds is just go, I know you're in trouble. Relax, float like a star, get control of yourself, let that body just normalize against that. That response is billions of years old. As Mike would probably say, we're tropical people, we're tropical fish, our background is. So let that response wash over to protect the organs, and then we can do something about it. And lying on your back and sculling and floating around. And what we did with the other research paper in that in minimizing risk is, I mean, the question is, if you've got a wetsuit, you've got about 10, 15 to 20 newtons of buoyancy. I urge every wetsuit manufacturer, put it on the lanyard, put a P-less whistle, like a Fox 40 whistle on your lanyard. So if you're in trouble and you're floating, get your lanyard from behind your back and blow and attract attention.
Oh, that's really a good idea.
You know, something like
Yes.
that. And then the other part of some of the work we've been doing is taking that step forward is high vis. We know that in oceans that high vis shocking orange or bright luminescent yellow green or an orange and shocking pink are really good colors to be seen on the water. So why aren't we getting advocated manufacturers and wetsuits to have it on our shoulders and our arms? So when their arms are up, the lifeguards can see things really quickly. The rods in our eyes can distinguish between a black and a bright color in their arms, knowing that they're okay. The moment they stop, we can see that because we've kept a track on them. But too many times we're seeing things camouflaged. So there's a whole big picture around here about float to live, carrying safety, basic safety, a warning systems like a whistle and your lanyard would be really good, changing manufacturers' idea. And then changing the color on your shoulders and your forearm. So when someone waves or is bobbing around, the lifeguards can see if they're in trouble or not.
So before I talk about manufacturers, here people say, well, that's cold water and hypothermia and the whole breath response. And so people aren't paying attention. I think it does relate to warm water also, what he did. Is
You
that
can still get
correct?
around 24 degrees, but then the other thing is you can still get heat illnesses in water. You know, the famous American poor chap who lost his life doing a 10K swim in Eilat. You know, you can get core heated temperature, or you could even ingest or inhale water by accident, and you only need about something like a liter and a half of fresh water and seawater to start the drowning chain. So
Exactly.
this isn't just, and people need to be aware that, you know, this is where we came away from secondary drowning and dry drowning and near drowning, all these terminology, because they were distracting of the way people get affected. There are a number of levels where drowning can happen. Just by tombstoning, you can jump in and have a gas response, and you can have that lethal dose go into yourself and into your lungs. It doesn't matter whether it's freezing cold or warm. Once that happens, you've gone past that lethal dose. So,
No, go ahead.
yes, you
Go
have
ahead.
these things.
That was really interesting about that research that I picked up. But a lot of people go, well, that's just cold water. We don't have to worry about that. And I'm going, no, that is not ex what he was talking about, that anybody can take in that much water and that kind
Yeah.
of surprise effect. You come in, you don't know you're going to do it. So.
Well, part of Mike's research, which we got dragged into, was the fact that USA Triathlon actually looked at why are so many deaths happening against cycling and running. And at the 2011 report, it was pointed out 79% of people were drowning in an event, and it wasn't hyperthermia or it wasn't hyperthermia or hypothermia. What was going on? And this was another element of Mike's work and Dr. Patrick Morgan's work as well, and Professor Shattuck's work over in the UK, that looked at that, which meant I was interested because guess what lifeguards do? They provide support for events. And it was another thing which you probably talked about, autonomic conflict, where it's initial response of when you have a load of people mass starting and they're not comfortable in the water, and it causes a problem that can literally stop the heart. You
Right.
know, this dry drowning or secondary drowning or cold water, this is something that's where people have a possibly a predisposed arrhythmia in the heart, not realizing in day-to-day stuff, but there is definitely a connection between, and we've seen two papers on this, between the fight and flight system, water hitting over the skin around your face and around your arms, and when you're kind of overextending breath holding at the start of a triathlon. It's the most dangerous part of an event, and what they've called it is autonomic conflict. So what does that mean for me? Well, the physiologists do their bit. My job is, right, okay, what do I do that for water safety? Well, I now know from that research, lab to life saving, that in the first 500 meters, there's no point having a boat there, and there's no point having a kayak there, because if these people go under, this is somebody that's very, very needs is going to be very, very sick and poorly. Their heart could have stopped. They need a quick intervention. So that's going to be a board or a swim with a rescue tube, and go and get them out of that pack really quickly and get their head out of the water. That's going to happen, and we know that's going to happen within the first 500 meters of an event. So now in the UK, with our event water safety management, we actually can map out the risk profile of a triathlon start or a mass swim start. We go, right, lifeguards in the first 500 meters, 500 yards. The next bit, you can have sit on top kayaks because now they're sorted and relaxed, but we'll flood it at the end because of post-immersion pressures and density, or post collapse, you know, from a long distance swim event. So we know how to, we actually now from research, going to the technical side, we actually know where to put our lifeguards for event safety.
Do we know that in the United States? I know you're an elite athlete in
Yeah,
training for the
not
next
yet, no, but
Ironman.
now they do. Yeah.
That's so in the first 500 yards, you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah, so we the guidance came out from Mike's work to Fina about that to try and not have a sharp turn in the first 400, 500 yards and have it straight and people to self almost self-seed themselves against good swimmers and relaxed swimmers. And this is because I can't remember what the ratio is, but it's like a 1 in 12 that we've got a problem with the heart. You know, like footballers that fall over because they've got this long QT syndrome. And I'm talking about physiology, and I'm not an expert in this, but we see this horrible situation where they stand up and also they just hit the floor and they've got defibs and a horrific situation. Well, these are one of many of these predisposed arrhythmias in your heart that you may or may not have, and you won't find out until the day. You wouldn't even know about it walking, going shopping, or whatever you do sports, but just that one moment. But with water, it has a little bit more of an adverse effect. And so we now teach our lifeguards and our event water safety managers that that's what you've got to be aware of, this autonomic conflict, that this is going to happen. May not be the cold shock response, as your colleagues in America go, well, we got warm water, that's not going to happen. But there is a response to this. So our lifeguards now will look very carefully now over that 500 yards about the effort, what's going on. If someone chokes or coughs, they're watching them very carefully. And if they have to intervene, they know now why, and also why our first aid teams are on the side, knowing that they need a defibrillator, high oxygen levels, and good CPR and a good core team, like a pit crew approach for like Daytona or Formula One. So we now know from the physiology, the research tells us where to put these people, what qualifications they need, and they need to be practiced in it as well.
I think when you come to the United States in April, is it when it is? You need to be presenting these things.
We'll try.
I mean, there's the United States Life Saving Association meeting right now in Idaho. I'm sorry your work isn't being presented there. That's really great information.
Knock on their door and said they want me to fly over and I can do it for them next year. Maybe Mike and I can come over. That'd be great.
Yes, that would be really cool. Hi. So, based on what you know, what I mean, people have been listening to this and it's really good information. Tell me now, what does your day look like as director?
Well, it's a really odd bag. It's the hardest question to answer, and I don't know myself, because my job's just evolved from being in the fire service and learning all those lessons from that. I'm thankful for that, and I'm very thankful to my old CEO who's retired now, Tim Coventry, who saw something in me and gave me the wings, and he said, "I just need you to do this." He was a really good advocate and support, and even to this day, the support I get from the board and allow me to do the things that I do. So what does that mean? I could have many meetings in different areas over the week. So here's the exhaustive list. I sit on the UK SAR Search and Rescue Operators Group. That's the how we operate and work together. The medical group and the volunteer group. I sit on the National Water Safety Forum England Executive Group, and Mike's the chair. And then I sit on their Technical and Education Committee. I sit on the I chair the ILS World, which is the World Body for Rescue Operations, and then above me is the Rescue Commission run by the CEO of Surf Life Saving Australia, and then there's the European part where I sit on their Civil Disaster Protection Group and their Drowning Education Group, and then finally, as Mike and I are members of the International Drowning Research Alliance as well, where everybody there on that group are all research-based people that share stuff and hopefully try and provide, an independent support mechanism to questions that we have. And if I don't know the answer, I go knock on their door because they're the doctors around that. So I'm very lucky. So that might mix all those things. The second priority is my life saving and my membership, or making sure they're supported in everything from horrible incidents to collecting the data around incident reports to make sure that and then collecting all the policies, making sure the policies are up to date and providing that support for that. So this year we've had just under 3,500 people being at intervention this year. It's been a busy year. So collecting that data and making sure that the clubs are aware, these are volunteers,
Right.
and they are providing phenomenal operational duties. And so, I'm lucky, I'm the one being paid. So my job is to make sure that they feel valued, and I do value them. It's to see their professionalism is amazing. And then the part of that is also supporting six of our search and rescue flood teams, that are getting called out. And we're now heading to storm season. Hence this conference this weekend, to get them ready, their management ready, ready for storm season. We've had our second storm come through yesterday. It was named by the French. So we are now experiencing more storms than we ever have. So it can go from being on the beach to help running our sport life-saving events. I could be there as the National Safety Advisor for there. It can be a conference, it can be policy, it can be supporting club membership, right up to national requests with the Coast Guard, with the police, fire, and then and all of a sudden I drop into research. So I have no idea. I just love the
Hey,
job and
Adrian,
I'm happy I
we
did it.
go back to when you said you started at seven. You thought your heroes were Marvel superheroes. I think you are a
Oh, yes,
superhero.
that's very
My
kind.
goodness. So
Yeah.
tell me, you were telling me in an email you wrote me, which was great, that you've experienced blue therapy and then the number of visitors and then the issues with SUP and stand up
Yeah.
paddler. So can we kind of
Yeah,
talk about that?
definitely. So we've seen an explosion since the pandemic, when the country opened up the borders. And literally, I remember during the pandemic that when the government said it's okay to go to the ocean, I put my hand in my head going, we've just opened the doors of hell to the ocean. And I knew we were in trouble. And I was in Australia at the time, in Tasmania. And I was talking to my CEO at the time, Tim, and going, we've got to do something about it. But we also have the pandemic, So I used my basic knowledge from being a member of the Urban Search and Rescue team about disasters, pick the low-hanging fruit, give the volunteers their training and do the job well so they get it. And that year alone, just to give you a context behind that, when there was no lifeguard on the beaches, we didn't want to look like lifeguards. There was no council lifeguards and we weren't allowed to look like lifeguards. So we had orange high-vis vests on and two people would come along and stand as where the area to bathe, and they weren't allowed to rescue. We had no idea of this disaster. And then I remember, for never forget the when I had to, I actually broke law, and I had to, we're on May, where we had one of the hot warmest days and the biggest king tides ever, and people were getting sucked out, and there was no lifeguard service, and I just said start rescuing them. So I had my phone going off. Literally, we're losing people, and I get emotional now because one of my friends, he actually pulled out two dead people, and when I realised it was his beach, I just said, "Jesus, please don't let it be my friend. Please don't." And it was, and he didn't want to speak to me, but that was a level of voluntary. It's the biggest voluntary response to a pandemic, but it was horrific to deal with those things. But that led to a big number. Over 3,600 lives were prevented from drowning. We thought we'd never see that number again. And then we plotted around the 100, 200, 260. And then the last 3 years, we have seen an explosion of blue therapy where people have gone out, wanting to swim in open water, wanting to stand on stand-up paddle boards. And because, again, we're seeing research from this now, which is backing this theory of when we see 24 degrees Fahrenheit, up in the mid-80s. The
Right.
drowning result, and this is through the National Water Safety Forum, the drowning is 4 to 5 times likelihood, because people want to go to the beach. We're like animals, we want to go cool off, so we go to the beach. What can we do? We'll go swimming. So my top three problems is open water swimming, not realizing the risks, and it doesn't matter if it's a lake, a river, or an ocean. It doesn't matter, and they don't think about the things of high vis or reading the weather or reading the currents. And the stand-up paddle boards, I'm afraid, are the same result. We're a place. I got really angry the last few years where you saw lovely, lovely males and females in pictures with their yoga pants doing stretching and not one PFD. Yet the advice behind that was wear a flotation device, but people weren't reading it. They were seeing the bloody picture and following that. The very advice you give, and you've just not thinking about the picture you're producing, which says 1,000 words. And then, unfortunately, the third part is just seeing a lot of parents, because they're fatigued, they all work hard, just turning their heads off. And they get to the beach, they want to relax and forget that their children are being swept away. So we've seen an explosion of this through sport. We've seen examples on that where I know with Paddle UK membership, SUP was around a membership of around 30,000. It's nearly 100,000 since pandemic. So we are busy picking those people up, and that needs to change. In a way that what I've learned from fire, and one of the things I'm trying to say, which my lessons I learned from fire, is how do we reduce fire deaths by 50% in 10 years? One is legislation. You've got to change the law. The second thing is go and speak to your manufacturers to say, can you do this? Can you put a whistle on a wetsuit? Can you wear the put colours on the PFD? Can sell a PFD with a water safety pack so your phone could go in there? So it's not just built with a PFD. You've got safe systems. It's just getting them to put the, because no one's going to mind about that. A customer, I'm pretty sure. And then the third part is, what is the advice around that? And lifeguards can't be everywhere. They can't be every 50 meters of every water space. So
Exactly.
we need to educate people. And like your colleague, we start from the school, we bring that as school planning, we educate around those things and build that into the point that when we're in the dust, they're wearing a PFD with a whistle or with high vis, they've got an aqua pack with their radio or their phone in, and they've got all those things. And it's as natural to them putting that on as it is for a firefighter to put a helmet and a breathing apparatus on. That's where we need to be.
That's such a great message. And if I didn't think you were sitting in the UK right now, I'd think you'd be talking about Hawaii because those are the issues. People come here, the water is warm, they just go in. They don't look up, they don't think about anything that concerns them. We have people on social influencers saying, you should do this in the water, and isn't this great? Nobody's wearing a leash doing anything on a stand up. And then we have parents, exactly what you're saying, who are busy, tired, working two or three jobs here. And, they get there, they want to relax, and they've come up with a message here that, phones down, eyes up
Yeah,
for your kids. So
it's a
everything
global
you're saying,
problem. It's a global problem. The
yes.
message, when I read your report, I just smiled. Went, it's the same in Australia. It's the same in the UK. Every country has the same problem, and the only way I've learned from this is with the work we did in fire was there has to be legislation. We have to
Yes.
tell, like you have fire prevention in your furniture, in your building. Why can't we turn around and go, legislation is going, if you have a wetsuit, it's got to have this, it's got to have what's the best practice on it? Why can't it have a whistle? Why can't it have an aqua pack? Changing that, very simple messages with simple legacy thought processes that provide a safe system of work for people later on, and it continues to be embedded. Once we've got that work, it's embedded in the culture. But we've got to embed that culture with the legislation, manufacturers, and how we teach people.
That's a great message. So I think you should work on one manufacturer, Adrian. One, just
Yeah,
one, right? And then
that'd be
once
great.
they see that, then maybe things will
But if
change.
they're listening, get in touch with us and we'll work with you.
Okay. All right.
Be the champion for the world. I
Yes,
challenge.
that's what you are. Now, two questions. The last,
Okay.
the second to last one is, what message do you have to give to our listeners right now about water safety? Anything you just want to say? You've said a lot.
I think we all enjoy water, and water's there to be enjoyed. And I would advocate everybody to have a fun around water, but pause and take the advice. The advice is all over the internet. The advice is with our lifesavers and lifeguards. Just a 3 second pause on your phone to find out the safety messages in your area or what to do will then allow the rest of the afternoon or your day to enjoy it. Because if not, you have a legacy of a shadow of or a dark cloud for the rest of your life, which I don't want people to do. So pause, think, and then you'll have a really good time around water, and everybody has fun. So that's where my message is.
Adrian, that's great. I mean, and you've been doing this work for a long time. So, what is your vision for the next
Ah,
5 to 10 years? What do you see?
yes. My vision is the very thing I'm. So it's a good question. We count the drowning stats at the top of the iceberg. There is no data collection on non-fatal drowning. We talk about fatal, non-fatal, and morbidity. So we collect fatal drowning. We have nobody in the country taking
Right.
non-fatal data.
Right.
If we knew that iceberg under the water, we would see the early warning signs, the near misses, as risk managers would call it, or the about what is the trend, what's going on, and two things will come from that: our preparedness for drowning. For the next phase or fashion or fad or whatever you want to call it, we'll be ready for about creating safe systems and improving working, seeing something going right, let's get industry involved, let's get legislation prepared. We could do that. The other thing is, drowning is not really important globally by a lot of countries' governments. A couple of hundred here or 600 in the UK, they're not bothered. They're against obesity and drug taking, they're not. But if we show the amount of non-fatal interventions that we are doing globally against the death rate, I am sure that iceberg would be huge, and it would then bring show value of life-saving organizations around the world to say, this could be the baseline, we don't know, but if you take away our funding or you take away our ability to do stuff or don't listen to this, this iceberg under the ocean is going to be tenfold. We've got off, in my mind, we have the finger in the dam, population is growing, climate change is big and increasing, or climate extreme. And so our thumb right now is in the dam with all life-saving organizations around the world. If we don't take this on properly and we don't look at these things and work with life-saving organizations around the world, that thumb is not going to be holding the dam much longer. So there's an awful lot being asked for by life-saving organizations around the world, and there's not enough perspective value on what they're doing. So governments get behind it, communities get behind them, because they are the people that are doing the work.
Thank you so much. That's great information because we know drowning's a process and that we just always just talk about fatal drownings. We don't talk about anything else. And I know Justin Semsrott's going to be at the same conference you're at doing a mental
Legend, not a
health
legend.
research
Yeah.
on all of that. So I hope you can come back and talk about your work again. I mean, I'm so honored to have you because you're so busy, as you said. You took up about 5 minutes saying what your day was, and then you've got to train for another Ironman. So
Yep.
I'm totally impressed. And I know that our listeners really gained a lot of information today, Adrian. Thank you so much for coming on.
It's my pleasure. I'd be delighted to come back anytime. So thank you very much, Margaret. And thanks for everybody listening. I hope they got something about it, and bring
Yes.
it back anytime.
Okay. Thank you so much. It's
God
great.
bless everyone. Take
Okay.
care.